is it really about?
Good morning, everyone. I'm calling the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today, we have numerous bills that we have scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. From my understanding and speaking with counsel, if we're going to have work sessions, only two of the bills are ready to go forward at this point, meaning we have the paperwork that we need from revenue and fiscal. And for those who are tracking those, Senate Bill 212 and 218 would be the only two that we can consider for work sessions if we so choose. So with that, there's no other formalities. We're going to go ahead and open up our first public hearing. This will be Senate Bill 230. Counsel, if you can give us a summary on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 230 prioritizes the payment of restitution to crime victims.
All right, thank you. And we have Mr. Boss here. Fred, thank you very much. And if you'll give us your name and all that, and then your testimony, please.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 230. Senate Bill 230 comes from the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. It addresses a long-standing issue for victims of crime that have been awarded restitution in a criminal money judgment. ORS 137-295 establishes a priority system for the disbursement of funds collected in a criminal money judgment. Category 1 is compensatory damages, Category 2, restitution, Category 3, obligations owed to the state, and Category 4 is any other obligations created by the criminal money judgment. For Category 1, every dollar is paid 100% to the victim of crime. Category 2 and Category 3 are paid together. Thus, for every dollar that is sent in payment from the defendant, 50 cents goes to the victim and 50 cents will go to the state to pay the state's obligation. This has caused distress among crime victims because they know that the defendant is paying on the obligation, yet they are only receiving a portion of the restitution. This payment scheme also flies in the face of recent reformation of the state's restitution laws, changing the focus from rehabilitation of the defendant to making the victim whole. Victims also have a constitutional right to prompt payment of restitution. Senate Bill 230 would address this issue, moving restitution into equal payment status with Category 1 compensatory fines that also go to the victim. Thus, the victim would be paid in full before the state is paid its monetary fines. We urge you to pass Senate Bill 230 out of the committee with a due pass recommendation. This morning I received from the Oregon Judicial Department a fiscal impact statement that I'd like to discuss with the committee. And it actually highlights what I just testified about, that on page 2 it shows that there is a, in the terms of the Oregon Judicial Department, a revenue shift. And we don't have, you'll see a column for 2009, 2011, 2013. Note 1 states that these are based on actual dollars of 05, 07. But we don't have the column that shows the actual dollars for that. The column here that is enumerated is what is Category 3, which are the various fines that make up payments to the state. And then the column therefore shows the breakdown there that OJD says that there would be a shift from those categories to the payment of restitution. There down at the bottom you'll see the amount that is shifted into the restitution column. I would categorize this more as not necessarily a shift, but more of a delay, because what it does is it changes the payment to paying the victim first and then paying the state second, as opposed to paying the state and the victim 50-50. There eventually will be a payment, and what this, if we extrapolate the numbers over time, there'll be a full payment for the state. It's just that there will be a prioritization so that the victim will be made whole first before the state receives its funds that then go to these various buckets. More than happy to answer questions. on the fiscal statement. Like I said, I just got it, but I'd be happy to try and give my explanation of what the figures mean.
Right. Before I take questions, Fred, my understanding is basically the perspective that DOJ is taking is that the courts or the state will still continue to get their money. It's just it's delayed because first out will be to victims through the restitution under the Category 1 having a higher priority, and then secondary would be what currently is now split between the two. And there just would be a delay. Now, I guess I will just put on the record, of course, if for some reason payments aren't continued to be paid, then there would be more than just maybe a delay where there would not be receipt of monies to the other various categories based on the priority of payout.
Chair Brzezinski, that entire statement is correct.
All right. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fred, the revenue statement that you passed out on page 2 says in a note that the change would also affect justice and municipal courts and revenues. And I wondered if you had an opportunity to speak with anyone representing the other court systems on how they would absorb the shift.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, I have not.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. On the first page of the revenue forecast, actually, it says that the effect would be a substantial negative impact on state funds. In part, even if it is just a shift, I would follow up on Senator Bonamici's concern. Is it going to cause a... Do we know if it will cause a cash flow problem within the within whatever activities are funded by that by the state's restitution or by the state's as being a recipient of the funds? Even if the long term effect is only a shift, the immediate effect is going to be a cash flow limitation for somebody.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt. I believe that is correct, that for the initial period of time, there would be a decrease to these accounts that would be made up over time. Some of this also depends upon the collection efforts that OJD has and how much money comes in. But that is a correct statement.
And yes. That actually leads me into my second question, that is the collection efforts of OJD. And is that something that you're comfortable talking about?
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Wissett, no. I would prefer that they be here to testify about their own efforts.
And
yeah,
are you done?
Yes.
Okay. Just I want to. Senator Wissett had to step out of the room. We only have two bills that potentially are even going to move today. That's Senate Bill 212 and 218. So 230, and the other two at this point, we don't have all the paperwork that we would need, even if we want to. I think there are a few questions here on 230. That we're going to want to have some additional information. Is there other questions, Senator Boquist?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, before we do move it, and I suppose in the interim, before I would be interested to ensure we at least let the cities and counties know that are affected that we're going to take their money and reprioritize it. Not that it's a good or bad idea, but just that we let them know.
They will.
The other thing, I guess we're kind of spanning the room. I wanted to see if anyone's here from the Department of Justice. Judicial Department. I'm looking at Fred's sign-in. There is. If you wouldn't...
Chairman?
Yes.
I would say from the Deputy State Court Administrator, but I haven't had any contact with this bill. I hear the issues and the questions, but I haven't seen the financial...
Okay.
And I could take... the questions back.
That'd be one.
Our colleagues.
And what I'll have counsel also making contact, because I think we do need to get maybe someone here can explain a few things to us. Mm-hmm. And let me just make certain there's no other questions.
I have a question. Another
Go right
question.
Ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, could you talk a little bit about, I see that this is a bill for the Restitution Reform Task Force, but can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned the confusion on the part of the victims of why am I not getting my money, the other policy reasons for this change and sort of the rationale for bringing this proposal forward to help us put it in context.
Senator Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, this The Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force has been working on reforming restitution for the last three sessions. It started out with to change the fundamental premise of restitution from a rehabilitation of the victim to making, I'm sorry, rehabilitation of the defendant to making the victim whole. So back in the early 2000s, we had Senate Bill 216, which did in fact do that, that stated that made the requirement that the victim receive 100% full restitution, and required the courts and the system to have hearing about restitution and to award all the restitution that the victim proved. From that point, in the early 2000s, each session we've had refinements as we worked on this law and seen the ramifications. The Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force is actually made up of all the players in restitution, the judicial, the victims, of defense attorneys, prosecutors, and under the auspices are run by the Attorney General. And various bills have come out of that. This is one that Senate Bill 230 is a bill that does address one of the prime issues that victims of crime have had for years. And we tried a version of it last time that it didn't get all that far. And this one is just addressing the problem. Many victims, and they have come and testified before the legislature in previous years, have stated they, in their community, they see the defendant, they know the defendant is working down at the garage, they know that the defendant is making payments, yet they're only receiving a portion of the payments, and it's entirely frustrating to them. What we have heard is that next to having the defendant put in incarcerated, the main thing that the victims want, the victims of crime, is to be paid full restitution. It's a big deal, and when they're not paid full restitution, that increases the feeling of victimization from them. And this bill is meant to place the policy choice before the legislature of making the victims whole soon. Make sure that they have the ability to enforce a constitutional right to prompt payment of restitution.
Thank you. And a brief follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Boss, do you know how this issue is handled in other states? If we're the only state that doesn't pay the victim first, that would be helpful to know. If this is going to be the first in the country to pay the victim first, that would also be helpful to know.
Chair Rosansky, Senator Bonamici, I know from anecdotal evidence that other states do it this way. If we are going to continue with other hearings, I can bring back specific states and how they do them, if that would assist the panel.
I think the other thing the chair is going to want to have is a little broader discussion as to the impact. Clearly, we're attempting to make the victim whole as quick as possible. But I also realize that requires the courts to be able to function, to be able to collect and to disperse. And so those are issues I think that we're going to need to get a little broader perspective from not only our own judicial department, but also at the local levels.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In my ignorance, I don't know what CFAA is. That's quite a big hit. What is CFAA?
I can associate.
I know it, but I can't remember.
Criminal fine.
The indigent defense would be about 2,000 hours of legal time.
Right. Chair Prusansky and Senator Whitsitt, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. If I may attempt to answer the question about what CFAA is, it is the criminal fine and assessment account. When criminal fines are ordered and paid by the defendant, and they're split out by restitution and then the other 50%, it goes kind of into a big pot, and then various things are paid from that. One of them is the list of agencies that the legislature appropriates criminal fine and assessment account money to DOJ is one of them, so is DPSST and also Department of Human Services.
Senator Wissett, there's a list that has been put together of different programs, including some of the, I'm going to say APSE programs, that's not the correct word, the Kids Center programs. I think they receive CFAA money, as well as there's another pot, but there's different programs that provide, let's say, services to those who are within the criminal justice system for whatever reasons, as well as some of the agencies that get a part of their operating cost through that process. Any other questions? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 230? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 230, open a public hearing on 212.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 212 establishes criteria for programs distributing victim assistance funds, authorizes rulemaking to establish criteria for distributing the funds, establishes an advisory committee to consult on the distribution of the funds, declares an emergency effective on passage. This one has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Besides Cynthia, I also have Deborah Bridges. And if you'd like to come on up together, that'd be great. And Cynthia, are you going to do the first presentation? If you'll sign in, and please proceed.
For the record, Chair Pazanski, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division within the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 212. This bill is really a technical cleanup bill. We administer funds from the criminal fine and assessment account to prosecutor-based victim assistance programs in five cities and 36 counties throughout the state. And the language in the statute has not been revised since the inception of the statute in the early 80s. And so as we started looking at this with our partners at the prosecutor-based victim assistance program, became a little uncomfortable about how antiquated some of the language was and how practice didn't conform with what was in statute. So we convened a work group inviting anyone from the victim assistance programs to come and work with us on language revision. So what you see in front of you is the product of that work group. With the exception of one addition, it does not change the requirements in the existing statute, but rewords some things. One of the significant changes, though, is it removes the word comprehensive. The current statute requires that the counties or cities have a comprehensive victim services program. The amount of money going to these programs from our office is not adequate to require a comprehensive program, and comprehensive isn't very well defined either, and we felt it was rather a setup for those programs to expect them to be comprehensive but not be able to fund them at a level that allowed that. And so the agreement of the group was that we move to a more core services type language so that at least these programs are providing core services to victims of crime, and those are defined in the bill. Again, very it's essentially the same as the existing statute with some updates. Another example of an update is there's language in the current statute that requires programs to assist in preparation and presentation of claims against the criminal injuries compensation account. I can guarantee you that most of the folks that get our money don't understand what that means. It really means that they help victims fill out crime victim compensation program forms. And so it's just one of those kind of clarifications so that the expectations of the programs are not confusing to them as they receive the funding. The one change that we did make, and again with the consensus of the group and the approval of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, is that we added a requirement that they notify victims of their rights under Oregon law, which is congruent with the constitutional amendment that passed last May and also congruent with current practice. So I can let my colleague Deborah Bridges speak to that, but the information that we got during the work group from all of the victim assistance directors, and again as approved by ODAA, is that this really reflects what the programs are already doing. And so that's why there is no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Ms. Bridges?
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I just am really here to echo
you
the sentiment.
Sign in. You give us your
name.
Oh,
I'm sorry. My name is Deborah Bridges. I'm the director of the Yamhill County Crime Victims Office. I represent basically the 36 counties out there. All of your counties have fabulous victim assistance directors, I assure you. And we've worked really hard with the department to align what we do in the counties with the language in this document. And we had a very good participation from our district attorney-based programs. And for the folks that couldn't be at the table or via phone, we all signed on as a buddy system to then articulate the changes to other directors throughout the state. So we have a large buy-in. We really want to be able to do the work that's outlined for us. We would like to have language that accurately reflects the work that we do. So this is what we're here asking for, support of the changes. And, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions about what the DAPs are doing.
Thank you. Senator Wissett.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Once again, we're asked to conform statute to current practices, and that is upside down. We should not be establishing practices that are not authorized by statute. I have no doubt that this is needed, but I just would point that out.
Well, Senator Wissett, I didn't take that statement. I think what I heard from the testimony was that this is the practice that they use to make certain individuals known. Now they're going to put the obligation into statute that it be done that way. It's not that they're in violation of what's, in fact, they're already giving more information.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. We are doing much more, I guarantee you, at the county level than what we are obligated to do under this document. Really, the language, it's semantics in some respects. Mm-hmm. It's just antiquated words mm-hmm. that we really need to be able to reflect from here on out what it is we're doing. And as we bring in new members to the victim services field, that this really makes more sense.
I have no doubt that's true. It's just that in their own sheet here, they say it conforms statute to current practices.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I have no problem with the bill, but I have the same, pretty much the same issue, because the common citizen who looks at the material that we get and they again align current law with practices in the field. I know that's not really what's transpiring here. I just urge the Department of Justice to use caution in the English language, that many citizens look at this and think, well, they're above the law, they're making it up as they go along. I know that's not the case.
I would suggest next time it should be conform statute to current practices being used that's above and beyond what is required by statute.
Very good, yeah. Mr. Chair. Whatever the common citizen will understand.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 212? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 212. And if I can get a motion on this one, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 212 to the floor with a due pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 212 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussions? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, since I complained, I'd be happy to carry it.
And the good senator, and is he designation, is that, I was going to say, yeah, I know that's not right.
No, West Valley.
West Valley.
Six counties.
I was going to say west of Salem, but I didn't knew that wouldn't quite get us there. West Valley will be our carrier. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we can also put the whatever's left over district, too.
Oh. A catch-all. All right. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 211. And counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 211 establishes the certification process for batterer intervention programs at the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. This one needs an amendment, and I think we received the amendment today, if I'm right. It will need a subsequent referral to Ways and Means when we choose, if the committee chooses to move it, but it's not ready to.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Stinson.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Again, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division and here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 211. I do want to add that you do not have amendments on this one. We have several bills in front of you today, and they're all passing in the night with some amendments, so there are not yet amendments formulated for Senate Bill 211. Some context for the creation of this bill. In 2001, the legislature passed Senate Bill 81, which charged the Department of Justice with promulgating administrative rules governing the functioning of batterer intervention programs, and that did happen. Part of the process of rulemaking was to form an advisory committee, and the advisory committee was codified then in the rules, so the advisory committee continues its work. And one of the pieces of work that the advisory committee has been looking at is what is the next step in making this process function well. Everyone involved with the administrative rule process recognized that it was a first step in working towards a more coordinated community response to domestic violence, having some set of standards for batterer intervention programs. But what was not included in Senate Bill 81 in 2001 was any kind of monitoring mechanism or way that there would be consistent review of programs throughout the state. And so this bill is seen as a next step in that effort. This bill establishes a certification and monitoring process for batterer intervention programs at the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. Some of you may be familiar with that agency, and its sole work is to perform regulatory, organize and carry out regulatory functions for various different disciplines, including, as passed last session, the sex offender treatment program. So this is a similar concept to what passed in 2007 regarding sex offender treatment. This is able to take advantage of economies of scale at the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. As we were, as an advisory committee, looking at how could this happen for monitoring and compliance, the creation of another staff position or statewide agency seems to not be the most efficient way. And so, again, patterning this bill after the efforts of the sex offender treatment folks, we decided to try to have it seated at the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. It includes provisions for program and development. One of the challenges for batterer intervention programs throughout the state is that there aren't enough batterer intervention programs. So there is a provision for programs to essentially be registered and progressing towards their certification in the hopes that it will encourage more programs to develop. And also involves an advisory board that would serve as subject matter experts to ensure that the administrative rules remain relevant. There is no fiscal impact on the Department of Justice. The payout would be from programs wanting to be certified. So the burden then falls on the batterer intervention programs. And my understanding is that we won't know until such time that the bill passes and OHLA is able to evaluate how many applications they might get, exactly what that cost will be. But we're hopeful that enough batterer intervention programs will wish to get certified, that, of course, the more that get certified, the lower the cost. So we'd be working with OHLA on that. There were some hiccups in the drafting process and some things that are not in this current bill that make it unfit to move forward at this time. And so would ask your patience as we work with our advisory committee and our community partners, such as the batterer intervention programs and the Community Corrections Directors Association and others that might have interest to craft some amendments for this bill so it can move forward.
Thank you. Questions? Senator, real question.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification to make sure. This does create a new committee. It does create a new position, and it does create a new fee. Is that correct?
Chair Pazanski, Senator Boquist, it creates a board that an advisory committee already exists in rule. It would really be a transferring of the language. It would be called a board instead of an advisory committee, very much the same functioning as it is. To my knowledge, it does not create a new position. It creates a new agency that the Oregon Health Licensing Agency has purview over, a new board that the Oregon Health Licensing Agency has purview over.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And obviously there's been discussion, envisionment of the fee, the size of the fee, and, I mean, at least theoretically.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Boklas, I'm not clear because OHLA has not been able to give me a commitment. I think it could range anywhere from $300 to $800. Again, it depends on how many programs sign up to get certified.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. And sort of a follow-up to Senator Boquist's question. How many, do you have a sense, I'm assuming that this was discussed, how many applications you anticipate receiving? I don't have a sense how many organizations, and I'm assuming most of them are private 1C3s, are providing, or, you know, the counties are contracting out with their mm-hmm. other organizations. I don't have a sense how many organizations are providing those services.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Dingfelder, excuse me. My understanding, there are about 150 or more active battery intervention programs, and of course that ranges from larger programs within other large programs. For example, there may be a battery intervention program within an agency that provides drug and alcohol treatment, then they might have a battery intervention program, they might have other, you know, some other services they provide. That's kind of on the large scale, and then on the small scale, you might have someone who is a licensed counselor in Eastern Oregon, and they do a group once a week for batterers, you know, very, very small scale. So my understanding is that the passage of the bill then will begin work in talking with better intervention programs who don't already know about this. I'm sure many of them do.
That was my next question.
About how to get certified. The other thing that goes hand in hand with this is the administrative rules that already exist but do need revision. And the existing advisory committee is already working on that. There are some things that need to be tweaked from the time the original administrative rules were put into place. Things that aren't working well, weren't realistic to be carried out the way that they're laid out in administrative rules. I think what's key is Department of Justice commitment to continue to work on those administrative rules so that the batter intervention programs see the rules, say that's a good set of standards for a batter intervention program. I want to be certified and follow those rules, and I want to make sure that the judges in my county and community corrections and the clients understand that I'm certified and, you know, am following a standard set of rules and that someone's monitoring me at the state level.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these administrative rules, are they based on evidence-based practices, on outcomes, on measurable, monitorable outcomes, or are they just procedural?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsett, the rules when they were created, we did a survey of available evidence-based practice. One of the difficulties in batter intervention, it's not a real fun topic for people to do research on. And as you know, evidence-based practice isn't related just to one study that comes out or one article. It's a body of evidence, as with drug and alcohol treatment. There's a lot of research that's been done. So the current rules are based on best practice in the field and what we knew at the time, evidence-based as we could get, that show that a coordinated community response meant well-functioning better intervention programs and the various components of them. We have been having conversations about the evidence-based practice issue, and that is one of the things that we need to consider in revisions of the rules is, if we don't have good evidence, how can we at least put good benchmarks in place for monitoring? And so that's one of the challenges we face in modifying the rules.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So, Cynthia, it seems to me that really this is the first stage, if this moves forward, to actually have some uniformity and consistency in programs across the state. I would assume that what might be coming toward the legislature in another session or two would be maybe a mandate that would require courts to refer them to certified programs as to ones that are not certified? Is that part of the discussions that's going on?
Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, actually one of the pieces of language that was omitted in the drafting process is not a mandate to judges, but a direction that they consider a certified program before they consider referring them to any other program that's not certified. Our partners in the judicial department weren't ready to take that leap to mandate. And my hope is that enough programs will get certified that from the judges that I've talked to, some of them currently are very uncomfortable knowing that they're referring defendants to these programs and they really don't know what the programs are doing. The onus of monitoring and evaluation right now is with the counties, with the local supervisory authority or the local family violence council or local domestic violence council, however that's configured in the counties. And those folks just do not have the resources or the expertise and time to do the kind of review of a program that needs to happen. They usually come together in a way where they come together maybe once a month and talk about domestic violence or family violence issues in their county, but they're not really set up to have a staff person or have someone that is an expert in batter intervention that's monitoring everything. So my hope is this will take some of the burden off of the counties and allow for a statewide standard, and that then the judges will feel more comfortable referring to a certified program because they will, in fact, know at least what standards those programs are following.
Let me follow up a couple of things. With that, I guess one of my concerns is knowing that in many areas of the state, more rural areas, some of these programs that may be available may not, well, let's just say they're working on a purse-string type of a budget, may not be able to get there. So I am conscious and cautious about having certified programs being the mandated referral until we know we have something there. And I think going back to what Senator Wissett has said, I would like to see if we're going to actually have these type of programs, how are they in fact going to be monitored and measured? Because the policy and philosophy that we have in the legislature, evidence best practices are what we're looking to go to. And knowing with some of the issues that we're dealing with, such as Measure 57, looking for outcomes, measurements, it would only be appropriate to make certain that whatever program that gets this certification is actually able to deliver and use the standard of programs that are actually going to be effective. Other questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 211? Not seeing anyone who's already closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 211 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 220.
I'm sorry.
I always get in trouble if I don't let counsel have
Thank
the first
you, Mr.
word.
Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 220 authorized the Attorney General to administer ongoing federal violence against Women Act grants. There's an amendment which is here today, I believe, that will authorize the Attorney General to accept any other crime victim grants. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we do not have, it's not ready to move today because we don't have the fiscals and the revenues. Thank you.
Thank you. Cynthia?
And Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, here again. I am Cynthia Stinson, Director of the Crime Victim Services Division within the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 220. We have some amendments, but I don't think they've been printed unless you just got them.
We've got the dash ones.
Oh, you did. Oh, wonderful. This bill is really a technical cleanup bill. We didn't have, when the Violence Against Women Act funds were moved from Oregon State Police to Department of Justice in 2007. We realized that although we did have authority because the legislature told us we could administer the grants, we didn't have it in statute, which is important for us to be able to refer to in our grant agreements. And so we wanted to make a change to ensure that it was clear that we were administering the Violence Against Women Act. When the new Attorney General took office and was reviewing the bills, He expressed the desire to have it be a little more broad in case there were other opportunities that we had, either federal or state, to have ongoing grants to administer, and that we wouldn't have to come back and name them all one by one. So the amendment that you see in front of you, and sorry, I don't have it in front of me, really just gives us the authority to administer state and federal grants on behalf of victims of crime. So that is the major cleanup of this bill. I do want to clarify, in case there's any confusion, in the summary of 220, the second sentence says it modifies the purposes for which monies in the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund may be used, and that, thank you very much, and that's actually inaccurate. This other tiny amendment does is removes the Oregon State Police as a mandated collaborative partner when we administer the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. In 2001, when the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund legislation passed, at that time, Oregon State Police had the Violence Against Women Act funds. Department of Human Services had some federal family violence funds, as well as some marriage license tax funds and some criminal fine assessment funds, and then we had the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund. Now that the Violence Against Women Act funds have moved to the Oregon Department of Justice, it's unnecessary for Oregon State Police to be within that mandated cluster of the state agencies administering money to domestic and sexual violence service programs. So as long as we were changing parts of the statute, we thought we would clean that up too. This bill does not have a fiscal impact of any kind, so I'm unsure why it's going to Ways and Means, but if it needs to go there, that's fine. Is it because it's not entered, the fiscal isn't entered yet officially?
excuse me, Mr. Chair. The committee may, now that we have more information about the bill, we consider asking to get that removed. I think it maybe it's just they looked at funds and thought maybe we need to go to Ways and Means.
It could have been that they thought some type of authority for disbursement of monies may need to be given. It sounds to me at this point we're not ready to go forward on this. The dash one, since we've just received them today, I know it's a pretty technical fix that we're doing there. I'm going to go ahead and just keep that in reserve in the sense of not acting on that today. The bill will be back before us. We'll do the adoption of that, and it will give us an opportunity to go through whatever else we need to as to where the appropriate designation for the bill would be. And Senator Bonamici and then Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have what I think is a technical question. The Dash 1 amendment adds the other grants to the Victims of Crime Act and Violence Against Women Act grants. But then it doesn't also add the other grants to the other part on page 2 and lines 5 and 6. And I don't know if that's intentional or if you need to expand that section as well. If you're expanding the first part, do you need to expand the second part?
Chair Krasanski, Senator Bonamici, thank you for that. I will check with Legislative Council and see if we need to make a fix there also.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand this, and this is the first time I've seen it, obviously, but I'm not sure this is just a technical fix. It is, it seems to bypass the legislature's authority to accept and administer grants. We do that in the legislature, we do that in the e-board, we can even do it retroactively. Mm-hmm. But the legislature has always had the authority to control the agencies in their acceptance and administration of federal grants, and I'm not sure that we want to abdicate that.
Okay.
You may. If I may, Chair Krasanski, Senator Whitsitt, this language is not meant to circumvent that process. It would be our understanding if another grant opportunity came before us, whether it was a one-time grant or new federal ongoing grant that was made available to us, that we would still go either to the e-board or to the legislature if it were meeting to ask first for approval to apply for the grant and then accept it if it were approved. But this in no way intends to circumvent that process. We would still come before the legislature or the e-board to ask for permission to apply. This would simply allow us, if we were to receive the grant, and especially for ongoing grants, the Violence Against Women Act grants and the Victim of Crime Act grants, VOCA and VAWA, as they are listed here, are ongoing grants. VOCA we've had since 1984. The Violence Against Women Act grants we just, as I said, received from Oregon State Police in 2007, but it's been an ongoing grant to the state of Oregon since 1994. We may have gotten our first money in 1996, OSP. So it's really about not having to come in and change the statute every time we get an authority from the legislature to apply and accept another ongoing grant. But I certainly can take back any concerns you have about how broad this is to the Attorney General.
I think, Ms. Stinson, the points have been made. I understand you're going to be working with the Legislative Council regarding, let's call it the catch that Senator Bonamici's brought up as to making certain that's covered. I think at the same time we need to have something as to ensuring the intention of DOJ and the authority of the legislature is not, let's say, going to be as cross-purposes. And I do understand from the perspective that if you have an ongoing grant that you want to make certain that you can continue to administer that grant and receive the money. But I also understand from Senator Wissett that I would assume that at the time that you would go before the legislature through whatever process, Ways and Means, or the E-Board, that they would be granting that authority when you're seeking the right to apply for those grants. That's the way I understand it normally works, but maybe I'm mistaken that maybe there's a two-step process there that you're trying to make it one step.
My understanding is that when the legislature or the E-Board approves application for a grant, it doesn't necessarily change the statute. The statutory change is so that if we get another ongoing grant, so it's not something kind of a one-shot deal that we're doing or a project that we ask the legislature to approve for us, but that we're wanting, as we did with last session with the Violence Against Women Act funds, to somehow accept or subsume an ongoing grant, that we wouldn't have to come in and tinker with the statute every time
right. That
happened. But I certainly can work with Legislative Council to make sure that the language is clear, that it does not circumvent the legislative or E-Board approval process. That was not the intent.
One other question, I guess, is this really applied to, let's say, multiple year grants? Is what I'm hearing is that once you have that authority, there's some question as to whether you have to come back every year, every session to reauthorize it?
Senator Prusansky, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my understanding is that for the ongoing grants that we administer, we do not come back every year or before the E-Board or before the legislature, that legislative fiscal has given their blessing for us to continue to administer those.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 220? We'll close the public hearing and have one last bill to hear today, which would be Senate Bill 218. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 218.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 218 changes eligibility and award amounts for crime victims' compensation, increases claim life for homicide to 5 years, adds benefit for victims whose offenders are moving through appellate process and parole board hearings, removes the prohibition on compensation for those living with or related to the perpetrator. There is a -1 amendment, and the -1 amendment adds injury to a person outside of the United States to the compensable crime eligible for crime victims' assistance. We have no revenue impact on the -1 amendment and no fiscal impact on the -1 amendment. So this one is ready to move if the committee so chooses. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Cynthia, it looks like you're going to be doing the presentation, and Deborah Bridges, Ms. Bridges, if you want to come back up, looks like you also like to give some comment, and when you're ready.
Chair Pansky, members of the committee, again, I'm Cynthia Stinson with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 218. I'm very proud to present this bill to you. It offers some improvements to our crime victims compensation program, allows some other victims access to our crime victims compensation benefits at different times in the criminal justice system where they may be having to essentially relive some of their experiences as a victim of crime. The first change that this proposes is to extend the life of a claim in cases of homicide to 5 years. The current life of a claim in our office for adult victims is 3 years. And as you all probably know, the journey for a homicide case is sometimes very long and complicated. When a homicide occurs, often we receive the claim, the application for a claim in our office, sometimes the same day or the day after. We work very closely with our victim assistance partners at the county level, like Ms. Bridges, and they submit those very quickly so that the families can get funeral benefits for their loved one. And as you know, sometimes it takes a while to apprehend a suspect in a homicide. So the claims are received and accepted usually in the same week that we get them. The 3 years starts ticking at that moment for these claims. The suspect can be apprehended a long time after that, and then the trial, especially if it's a trial and not a plea negotiation, can take even longer. So we can have families, survivors of homicide, whose claim benefit time has run out even before the trial is over, which is, as you might imagine, very hard on families. So we actually had a request from one of our crime victims service partners in the field, Crime Victims United, to extend the life of a homicide claim to 5 years. So that is what we're proposing with that specific change. This also allows victims whose offender is going through certain parts of the criminal justice process to have access to limited counseling benefits and some transportation benefits. Specifically, offenders who are going through the appellate or collateral processes, victims have a right to be at some of those hearings, and as you might imagine, it can be very traumatic for them, especially if the offender is appealing the actual conviction or if they're appealing the sentence. It's very hard for families, and so we want to be able to extend some limited benefits to them around the time of those hearings. Also, we would like for victims whose offenders are required to go before the parole board for release hearings to have some access to benefits. Again, it's a very traumatic experience. Victims are do have a right to speak at a parole board hearing, and many victims do, and it would be helpful for them to have some access to counseling support. In these times when insurance benefits are inaccessible for many Oregonians, our program often ends up being the safety net for them to be able to get some counseling around these issues. The amendment that you have in front of you adds one more benefit that would allow Oregonians, those living in Oregon who travel abroad and are victimized, which unfortunately does happen, to be able to be eligible for benefits with our program. Right now, we can't accept those claims unless somehow their victimization is related to an act of terrorism. And most foreign countries, in fact, I don't know of any foreign countries that have crime victims compensation programs. All of the 50 states do, so it's not a problem for Oregonians traveling within the United States. But when Oregonians go abroad and are victimized, then they often have no way to receive benefits. So that's the Dash 1 amendments speak to that change. The final change that I want to bring to your attention, only because it may seem a little strange, I want to explain it. It's at the very back of the bill. At the time the compensation program was created in 1977, it began in 1978 and started accepting claims. For whatever reason, there was language in the statute that said if you were related to or living with your offender, you weren't eligible. And what we've learned now, of course, is that unfortunately, most people are victimized by someone they're related to or are living with. In 1987, that statute was changed, but there was a gap in time. So this happens for the most part with people that are adults now but were victimized as children and report the crime and move forward with the case. or try to move forward with the case and then want to get some counseling benefits. It's very difficult for us to say you were victimized in 1985, you're not eligible, essentially you're not a victim. So this affects a very small number of victims. It's kind of a little blemish on our program, and we thought we would fix it as long as we were here making changes. So those are the main points I wanted to point out to you today. I'm happy to take questions.
My name is Deborah Bridges. I'm the director of the Yamhill County Crime Victims Office, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 218. I could relay horror stories to all of you for each one of these points that this bill will fix. And it is so important for crime victims to be able to have access to this counseling. Ms. Stinson, you know, talked about the economic impacts that we have in our communities and the lack of access to counseling. These are very traumatic hearings that people will be going to. So I can't not underestimate how important it is for these victims to be able to have a way to gain services during such a difficult time. We work very closely with, you know, when a case ends in our community, it doesn't end our involvement with our crime victims. And we monitor cases that are going through the appeals process. I'm in direct conversation with those victims. Where is it going? We go to parole board hearings with them. I've sat in basically very undesirable rooms with victims who are very close to the person who's perpetrated the crime against them. It's just a very unsettling circumstance for them to find themselves in again and again. And so I just really need to be able to reiterate how important it is for these victims to have some way to help support them through this continuation of the process.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about, not necessarily about the policy, but about the practicality of the amendment on the Oregon resident who's injured as a result of a compensable crime outside the United States. And I can understand where you said other states have programs, but I'm thinking of an instance, and I'll use an example. At the risk of being anecdotal, my mother was traveling in Poland, and she had something stolen off her person, and she wasn't injured, fortunately. But had she, so I don't think it would be a compensable crime. But if she had been injured, the situation was they took them into a little village and wrote up the report on a manual typewriter in Polish and gave them copies of nothing. So if she were to come back here, how does somebody, you know, how is that, how do you deal with the lack of records about what happened in that type of instance where somebody's traveling in a country that doesn't have record keeping? For example,
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, very good question, and I think that will be a challenge we'll have to face. Currently, we do work with the foreign consulates, especially when a homicide occurs in Oregon and the body is shipped back, or there's some complication with transferring. So we would work diligently through translators, if possible, to try to get at least a police report. We understand that the standards for reporting and recording information about crimes varies around the world, but without this amendment, victims wouldn't even have a chance to try for benefits, unless it were related to terrorism. So we'd like to at least be able to try to work with them, to try to seek out that documentation if we could.
The follow-up comment I submit, it would probably be even more difficult in cases of terrorism to get records. So.
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, they're often very well publicized, and we often can get at least a verbal confirmation from some authority that it was related to terrorism or an investigating agency. So we don't necessarily need full police reports, all of the details, to be able to make a decision about whether or not a crime is compensable. So for those cases, we are usually able to, through our resources, confirm that it was terrorism related.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair.
Since we're going forward this, I guess I'm a no on the dash one, and for and let me expand just slightly on that, Mr. Chair. And it comes down to the persons outside the United States. I mean, we have a safety net program, and that's the intent of it. In this day and age, to travel in a foreign country costs thousands and thousands of dollars. If you're a federal employee, you must have Defense Base Act insurance to travel abroad, which covers the expenses to bring you back, either if you're deceased or whatever, so on and so forth. I travel internationally all the time. A one-time policy to cover those expenses to ensure you get back by very reputable organizations like SOS and stuff, you know, it's as low as $65 of the cost for your trip, or as expensive as $150 for living for an entire year in a foreign country, and it's covered there. And I see this. It's a great program. It's a safety net program, but it is the personal responsibility of our citizens who travel abroad outside of the country to take these things into consideration. And we do have generally limited funds in these, and they should be a safety net. And I know there are several of us who travel internationally, and we shouldn't be given safety net funds because we choose to do so. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I just want to, I guess, give some comment. Reading the text of what came from DOJ, I would strongly urge you to consider using different terms than what I see. On the memo, it talks about, under the first bullet, extending the life of a claim. The use of the word life in this context, I would say, is not appropriate. Same thing on the summary, increases claim life. Instead, I would suggest that you think of something like increasing the time period to file a claim when we're dealing with homicide issues. The chair is going to take this one under advisement based on the comments I've just heard from Senator Boquist, and I do have the intention of moving the bill forward, but I do want to have a little time for the members to reflect as to the comments that have been made, and we'll get it scheduled for a work session and take up the bill at that time. And if there anything else? All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing of Senate Bill 282. And Council, is there anything else that we need to cover today?
No, Mr. Chair.
That will conclude our work for today. I understand or believe that we're scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, at 8:30.
That's correct.
And we'll continue at that time, but we're adjourned for today.